radio as his chair ripped free of its mounting on the ship's deck and crashed through the gaping hole in the bridge where the rock had gone through. He felt his left arm snap, and a dizzying wave of excruciating pain shot down his spine. Then he felt and heard nothing. He was spinning slowly, slowly through empty space, still strapped into his broken chair. He could feel nothing below his neck. He could hardly breathe. Through tear-filled eyes, he saw the shattered remnants of Gormley's fleet, broken and smashed pieces of spacecraft, bodies floating in their spacesuits, a proud armada reduced in a few seconds to a slowly spreading patch of debris. "Flotsam," he thought idly. "We are going to die in this empty wilderness."
"My God," whispered someone on the bridge of the Samarkand. Harvin also stared at the destruction. The Astro fleet looked as if it had gone through a shredder, a meat grinder. Bodies and wreckage were strewn everywhere, spinning, tumbling, coasting through space. "Should we pick up the survivors?" his pilot asked in a hushed voice. Harvin shook his head. "There are no survivors." "But maybe some..." "There are no survivors," he repeated harshly. But his eyes lingered on the display screen. "A few hundred new asteroids have been added to the belt," he told himself. "Some of them were once human beings."
Astro Corporation Headquarters. "Wiped out?" Poncho asked, her insides suddenly gone hollow. "Every ship," said Jake Wanamaker. "No survivors." He looked grim, beaten. "What happened?" Wanamaker was standing before her desk like a man facing a firing squad. Poncho pushed herself to her feet and gestured him to one of the comfortably padded chairs arranged around the small oval table in the corner of her office. Feeling shaky, her knees rubbery, she went to the table and sat next to her military commander. "We're not certain. We got a brief signal that they used small asteroids, some of them no bigger than a man's fist, and rammed them into Gormley's ships."
"How could they do that?" Poncho asked.
"Attached a plasma rocket and a simple guidance system to the rock," said Wanamaker. "Doesn't have to be fancy. Just juice the rocks up to very high velocity and ram them into our ships, like buckshot hit in paper bags."
"And they're all dead?"
Wanamaker nodded bleakly.
"Jesus, suffering Christ," Poncho thought. 13 ships. 150 people, just about."
"I think I should tender my resignation," said Wanamaker. Poncho glared at him. "Given up?" He flinched, as though she'd slapped him. "No. But a defeat like this, you'll probably want a better man to head your war." Shaking her head slowly, Poncho said, "No. I want you, Jake. One battle doesn't mean we've lost it all." But inwardly, she thought, "I want you to keep on heading the military operations, but I'll take charge of this goddamn war. Humphreys might have the edge on us militarily, with more mercenaries and more ships and better experience, but there's more than one way to fight a war." To Wanamaker, she said, "I'm not giving up. Far as I'm concerned, this war's just started." "I have not yet begun to fight," he muttered.
"I heard that one," Poncho said. "John Paul Jones, wasn't it?"
Wanamaker nodded. "Okay. You recruit more mercenaries. I'll buy more ships. For the time being, Humphreys has the run of the belt. He's going to attack any Astro vessels he can find out there, try to drive us out of the belt altogether."
"Convoy him."
"Convoy?"
"Don't let him sail alone. Put them in groups. It's harder to attack a formation of armed ships than a single ship."
"Makes sense," Poncho agreed. "I'll send out the word right away."
"I think Yamagata Corporation can provide us with reliable mercenaries."
"Good. Go get them."
It took a moment for Wanamaker to realize he'd been dismissed. It only hit him when Pancho pushed her chair back from the conference table and got to her feet. He shot up and started to salute, then caught himself and reddened slightly. "I've got a lot of work to do," he said, as if excusing himself for leaving the room.
"Me too," said Pancho. Wanamaker left, and Pancho returned to her desk. She called up reports on where the Astro ships were and where Humphrey's vessels were. A holographic representation of the vast space between Earth and the belt took form in the air beyond her desk. A huge, dark expanse with flickering pinpoints of light showing the positions of the ships. Astros in blue, HSSs in red. There was a cluster of ships between the Earth and Moon. Pancho blanked them out to simplify the three-dimensional picture. "Craps! There's a lot of red ones out in the belt," she said to herself. "And those are just the ones we know about. Humper's probably got a lot more out there, moving around the belt without any telemetry or identification beacons for the IAA to pick up." She had the computer identify the ore freighters, logistics carriers, and ships carrying miners to specific asteroids. Then she added the freelancers, the prospectors and miners who worked on their own, independent of the big corporations. Minutes ticked into hours as she studied the situation. "We're outnumbered in the belt 2-3 to 1, Pancho saw. "A hump's been building up his fleet out there for years now. We've got to play catch-up." "But why should we play their game?" she asked herself. "That's what we were doing with Gormley, and look what it got us." She leaned back in her softly yielding desk chair and closed her eyes briefly. What's the point of all those ships out in the belt? To bring ores to the factories on Earth, or in Earth orbit, or here at Selene? She answered her own question. She stared at the hologram imagery again. Flickering red dots representing HSS ships were spread through the belt, with a particular clustering around Vesta. But a thinner trickle of red dots was plying the lanes between the belt and the Earth-Moon vicinity. "They've got to bring the goods back here," Pancho saw. "That's the whole point of mining the rocks. If we can knock off their ships coming earthward, we can hit Humphreys in the pocketbook, strangle his cash flow, cut his profits down to nothing." She sat up straight in the desk chair and said aloud, "That's the way to do it. Let him have the belt for now. Stop him from bringing the ores to market." "We don't need naval tactics," she realized. "We don't need battles between fleets of warships. What we need is more like a gang of pirates, like the old Seahawks from Queen Elizabeth the I's time. Privateers. Pirates." And she knew just the man who could lead such a campaign. Lars Fuchs.
"All of them?" Humphreys asked, as if the news was too good to be true. Vicky Farrar was not smiling, but it was clear from the pleased expression on her face that she was happy to be able to bring her boss a positive report. "Every Astro ship was destroyed," she repeated. They were in the big library bar on the ground floor of Humphrey's mansion, alone except for the robot bartender which stood at its post, gleaming stainless steel reflecting the ceiling lights. "You're sure?" Humphrey's asked. "The report came directly from the Yamagata team. Their idea about using the rocks worked perfectly. The Astro fleet charged right into them. No survivors." "This calls for champagne!" Humphrey strode to the bar. The robot did not move. Nettled slightly at the machine's obtuseness, Humphreys called out, "Bartender, champagne!" The gleaming dome-topped robot trundled sideways along the bar and stood precisely at the wine cooler. Two slim arms extruded from its cylindrical body, opened the cooler, and pulled out a bottle of Clicquot. It trundled back to Humphreys and held up the bottle so he could inspect the label. "Fine," said Humphreys. "Open it and let me sample it." "How did it find the right bottle?" Farrar asked, coming over to sit on the stool next to him. Even though it was dinner time, for most people, she was still in her office attire, a miniskirted baby pink suit that hugged her curves artfully. "There's a sensor in each hand," said Humphreys, watching the dumb machine gripping the cork. If he drops that bottle, Humphreys thought, I'll run him through the recycle.